Hello, welcome to the UAV Digest, your weekly podcast about the world of UAVs, people, and machines. I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, and my co-host with me is...
I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And Max, for our second episode, we have our first guest.
Our guest this episode is Jamie Dodson. Now, Jamie is the Foreign Intelligence Officer and Senior Technology Protection Engineer for the U.S. Army Aviation and Missile Command. Jamie, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, guys.
Now, Jamie, you've got over 30 years experience in intelligence operations, and you've kind of been everywhere. You've been with the Special Operations, Army Aviation, Airborne Infantry, Military Police, probably in more countries than I have fingers and toes, so quite a broad experience.
Well, you know, 30 years plus in the military does tend to get a person around just a little bit.
It does.
Since I've retired, I've only been traveling maybe 15 or 20 times.
Well, that gives you some time to do some writing, because Jamie is also an author. He writes the award-winning Nick Grant Adventure Series, which is sort of adventure fiction. Maybe that's how I classify that, Jamie. Is that a good description?
Sure, I'll take it. You know what they say about any type of publicity is good publicity, but I think I would probably call it historical fiction.
That's it. Very good. Okay, thank you.
And I can vouch, having read the first three, they're amazing books. I'm just waiting for the fourth one, Jamie.
I'm getting beaten up about that quite a bit. Unfortunately, life seems to be getting in the way.
All right, David, what are we going to talk about this episode?
Well, Max, our first story will be about sense and avoid, making sure that our aircraft, when they get integrated into the airspace, the drones do not hit other aircraft. Our next topic will be the Arcturus T-20, which reached a new high-altitude mark with its 17-foot wingspan. And our third story, which is directly involves our guest, is J-Lens, which is a series of aerostats that are going to be tested over Washington, D.C. and Baltimore.
All right, very good. Let's get started. Our first item comes from NASA. This is sense and avoid technology evaluated in week-long flight tests. So unmanned aircraft, obviously, they have to know how to avoid other aircraft, and maybe especially other unmanned aircraft. And the term used for that is sense and avoid, although we are seeing some folks call it detect and avoid, but we'll stick with sense and avoid here. And the MITRE Corporation has developed some software in conjunction with the University of North Dakota, Draper Labs, and NASA's Langley Research Center, and they've been conducting some demonstrations. They've been using a Cirrus SR-22 as the, quote, UAV, although there's been a pilot aboard in case that was required, and they've also used a Cessna 206. And what they're trying to do is test this software that would allow UAVs to detect others. I mean, this is kind of a critical aspect to the commercialization of UAVs, David, isn't it? Particularly with respect to those operating in the commercial airspace.
Absolutely, Max. The ability of the aircraft to detect another aircraft is imperative if we're going to have drones flying independently in the airspace. The NASA Langley facility uses an SR-22 with a pilot. However, the aircraft, for all intents and purposes, is flown from the ground. It is then flown into the airspace of the 206 to see if the aircraft is able to detect the other aircraft and do a maneuver to avoid it, either go up, go down, go left or right. And when we integrate aircraft into our flyways, I mean, it's going to be imperative that these aircraft have the ability to realize that they are in danger or they're endangering somebody else, because we do not want a drone taking out an airliner over a major city, because that would be catastrophic. The Langley program actually has been in a while. In 2011, I was at Langley Air Force Base for their open house, and I did get to interview someone who was on the crew of the SR-22. I mean, it is flown as an unmanned aircraft with a pilot. Now, for all intents and purposes, takeoffs and landings are done by the pilot. However, once the aircraft is airborne, it does fly by remote control by a ground station at Langley. At that point, it was a very infant test, and they have been working on this project for a substantial length of time.
Now, this system that's being tested uses ADS-B as the sensor. That's the Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast System as the sensor. And this is, as we mentioned, this is kind of a critical aspect. The Aviation Rulemaking Committee that the FAA chartered developed some proposals for unmanned aircraft. And what they came up with, the proposal, is that above flight level 180, that unmanned aircraft would have transponders. But below that, or for UAVs that can't handle a payload of that size, so it's to be particularly smaller UAVs, then sense and avoid is going to be required for these to operate in the commercial airspace. So the development of the software is kind of key. Now, an interesting aspect of this is the liability issue. When TCAS was created, that's the Traffic Alert and Collision Avoidance System, it took many, many years and was government-funded, and in part because as a government-funded project, companies, it removed the liability issue for industry. And so the conversation here is that it really needs to be the same kind of arrangement. MITRE or any other corporation developing this really can't handle the risk of the liability that could come if there was a collision of some sort. And then the other thing is that the TCAS didn't come cheap. It cost a little under $1 billion to develop TCAS. So, you know, we may be years away from seeing something that we can apply to UAVs, but at least we're going down the path.
And folks, keep in mind that ADS-B is known colloquially as Next Gen. And the Next Gen project has been running for years now. We need to realize that is not a fully integrated program yet itself. So we have a very large learning curve for this technology.
Max, you know what amazes me is that they haven't introduced any other kind of sensing modalities.
Yeah, that's a good point, Jamie. There's some conversation. Some of the articles talk about or mention that and say that the FAA is not going to want to see a system that is totally reliant on one system, in this case the ADS-B. There needs to be some kind of a backup or some kind of alternative in place. So yeah, that's an issue that's going to have to be addressed. All right, moving on. We also see the Arcturus T-20 has been flown to a rather high altitude, David.
That's right, Max. The Arcturus T-20 has a four-stroke engine and was being flown at 23,000 plus, which is a record for that class of UAV. The Arcturus is advertised as a HAL. And as we said in our Zero episode, HAL stands for High Altitude Long Endurance. The aircraft is capable of flying for 16 hours on that four-stroke engine. The advantage of HAL is you have an air platform that is orbiting over your area for a long period of time, providing lots of information. You could use it for fighting wildfires like we've had out west this year. You could use it for customs and border and custom patrols across the border. You've got a long period of time in which the aircraft is observing its environment. The other important advantage is at the high altitude of 23,000 plus feet, you can imagine the coverage area that the aircraft provides. It provides a very sizable swath looking down from that height.
It would also make a very nice reconnaissance platform for other uses.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jamie. There are a number of missions that this could be suitable for. David, did you mention the payload on this?
The aircraft is capable of carrying 65 pounds of payload. With miniaturization, of course, that could mean multiple things like radars, infrared cameras. If you have a GoPro, you know how small that is and how effective a camera it is. So 65 pounds is a reasonable payload that you're putting in altitude for a long period of time.
That's roughly equivalent to our RQ-7 Shadow that Boeing makes in size and payload. And we've got a few thousand of those things flying around, too. I'm talking about the Army.
Yes, and I think that I've seen some commentary that mentions that and says that, you know, that with these volumes of drones that have been used in military applications as Afghanistan and so forth, if kind of winds down, that these companies are going to be looking increasingly for commercial applications because they don't have the sort of the military volume to support them. Does that seem like a fair assessment?
Yes, there's two programs within AMCOM, the Army Aviation and Missile Command that I work for, and also the Aviation and Missile Lab, which is on Redstone Arsenal. And both of those programs, they're in their infancy, but what they're trying to do is leverage some of the existing technologies in our different sets of UAVs and make them available for commercial use within the United States. There may be we have some foreign military sales going for more of the military spec vehicles, but essentially what we're trying to do is we've learned a lot because, for example, at the beginning of the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, the United States Army had 54 UAVs, or UASs as we're calling them now. Mm-hmm. In the end of the war, we had 4,000.
Wow, what a huge increase.
Right, and we've still got, I think, well, we crashed a few, lost a few others. We don't want to talk about that here, but we've got about 3,500 actual flyable.
What will become of those? Will they just get mothballed, do you think, or find other missions elsewhere?
Well, some of the older ones, we're building new variants to come on board from the lessons learned from our experiences over there. So some of the older ones will be either mothballed or put into the defense disposal yards. You know, you go down and buy an old Jeep, you could go down and buy an old UAV or UAS. But essentially what we're going to try and do is update all the older ones with newer ones with higher payloads, longer duration, and heavy fuel engines. I don't know if you guys have talked about that at all.
No, we haven't actually. What's that angle?
Well, a heavy fuel engine, in the military, it makes a lot of sense because that way you can use any kind of fuel in the UAV. You're not restricted to avgas or J4. You can even use diesel. And the energy density in diesel is actually a little bit higher than most other fuels. So what we're trying to do is leverage that diesel technology in our UAVs. And you've seen a lot of the civilian aircraft are starting to go to diesel engines. In fact, you guys did an Airplane Geeks podcast on the Cessna diesel, I think, about a year ago or so.
Yes, we did.
So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get that heavy fuel engine in place so that we can burn any fuel. It'll last longer. It's a simpler engine, less maintenance involved. So that's where we're going with the diesels.
All right. Now, another project that you're involved in, I understand, is the JLENS project. That's the Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Defense Elevated Netted Sensor.
Easy for you to say.
It's pretty difficult. And these are aerostats, helium-filled.
Yes, that's correct. They are helium-filled aerostats. There's two per system. One system carries a surveillance radar and over-the-horizons radar, which is, you know, we're able to do that by hanging it underneath a balloon. So it's we have a target tracking radar. And the neat thing about JLENS is that it plugs in. It's kind of they like to say plug and play, but it's a little bit harder than that. Essentially, you jack it into your air defense network, and you can use the information coming from JLENS and the targeting radar to actually target other weapon systems, since the JLENS itself, it does not have any weapon systems organic.
Right.
It's an excellent system for moving target, like moving target indicators. It can pick up, I got to be careful, I'm going to get myself in trouble, but
yes.
Small radio RCS, radar cross-section targets at great distances. And we've actually, we're in negotiations with a couple of our allies who are in other parts of the world who may be interested in picking up a couple of our systems.
Now, Jamie, these are tethered or moored aerostats. They are not free-floating or they're not manned or in orbit. They are actually tethered to a moor, correct?
David, as long as nothing goes wrong, that's exactly right. We have unfortunately lost one or two. They're 74-meter, we call them tethered aerostats. They have a mobile mooring station, and they have cables which go up to them, providing power and also some control, very little control, mostly up and down. They're rated to about 30 knot winds. Don't quote me on that because that's always changing. And of course, if it gets higher, you got to crank the guy down. You got to crank it down to save the system. We have had a couple of systems that were one in test to see, you know, at what point it would fail, and we managed to reach that point. I think it was about 6 weeks ago. I don't know. So we had a 74-meter balloon drifting away with a very interesting payload packet on it, and we had to send someone to shoot it down.
Is that really what you had to do?
You would be amazed how many 20-millimeter rounds can go into a 74-foot aerostat, and the darn thing still keeps flying.
Oh, my.
And, of course, it's a balloon, so your, you know, your air-to-air missiles could conceivably bounce off.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not suggesting that's actually what happened. I'm just speculating here with you guys.
Of course.
And, Jamie, we are talking about UAVs. Is it fairly autonomous as flown? Or is it manned, and how does it maneuver? How does the whole process work?
It's queuing, if you're familiar with that concept. What happens is remember I said this has incredible range and great resolution, but not extraordinary resolution. So what you would do if you're a mission commander and you've got the thing up there, you've got the JLens up there, you've indicated a target, what will happen is you can cue a UAV with a sensor packet to go in, you know, whether it's a Shadow or maybe an old Hunter. One of our systems, even a Predator, can go in with an electro sensor, put an IR payload, and even a radar payload to get a really close look at what exactly it is we've got out there. Because, you know, it's never good press to think you're attacking a fast attack boat when, in fact, what you're doing is shooting down or sinking some fisherman's boat. So that's what we would use it for more than anything else, cueing our UAV or UAS, as we call them, sensor packets to go in and take a closer look and get positive ID way over the horizon, long ways away.
Now, these are going to be deployed over Washington, D.C. That's the plan, correct?
Yes, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I believe the first system is there now, and it's a fantastic system. I'm obviously very much a proponent of it. I was the initial technology protection engineer on the system, working with the systems engineers, and the other, I think we're going to put one in Baltimore, and then we'll see what happens from there. What we really need to do is... the big downside for JLens is it does tend to have a large manprint footprint. In other words, those balloons, you remember the old movies of the Hindenburg coming in, you got 10,000 guys, you know, pulling on the lines to get it down.
Right.
This is a little smaller, but it still takes a lot of guys and gals to wrestle that thing into the ground in the mooring mast.
Because this is going to go up to around 10,000 feet, I understand.
It can.
It can.
Yes, it can. It may not always be. Mission profiles will vary based upon, you know, terrain, your targeting, what you're trying to defend. Essentially, though, what they're going to do is they're going to vary that altitude up and down a little bit.
And can we say that they're kind of fully developed? We've seen some other, you know, military aviation programs where kind of final development seems to follow deployment. Are we all tested out and ready to go with these, or do we still have some testing and some development work to do?
Well, most military systems are continually being tested and upgraded. I can tell you that the JLens system successfully passed its milestone C, so it is ready for limited, it's called LRIP, limited run, initial production.
Yes.
So they're going to start pumping out, yeah, that's right, you build turbine engines, you should know that.
I know all about that.
So we're going to, they'll pump out a few of them, and then my guess, and I certainly don't know, funding is questionable in these days when funding is, you know, tight everywhere, and the fiscal year 14 funding is questionable at this point. I think there's enough to get the program through one more year of development, and then we'll have to make a decision as to what we want to do. I'm hoping it doesn't become like the most successful Army program that was never deployed. the first UAV called the Hunter. It was brilliant. It got through all of its tests, got everything done. It was ahead. It exceeded all of its milestones. And then about 2 months afterwards, they canceled the whole program.
Oh, dear.
I don't want that to happen for JLEN, since it's just too good a program.
All right. Well, we'll follow along with it for sure.
There's a couple of good sites which you can go on the web. If you just go in and type the letters P as in Papa, E as in Echo, O as in Oscar, PEO, Missiles in Space, then JLEN's after it. There's a lot of open source material which will tell current information on the JLEN system and where we're at in test and what the future might hold for us.
Okay, great. We'll put that link in the show notes. All right, let's move on to our last item. This is an article in The Atlantic called The Killing Machines. And this is written by Mark Bowden, who's a national correspondent for The Atlantic. And it's a rather lengthy piece. It covers a lot of ground in terms of describing the military use of drone strikes. He talks about the fact that, you know, drones in some cases elicit a very strong emotional reaction from people.
Max, I believe the article is a good primer to all of the arguments for drones and drone strikes. It does present the fact that it is a new modern tool, but it does present how the image of David versus Goliath and the consequences of someone who doesn't actually feel the killing, or when you're so removed from the front line of the battle, is a new experience. Fighter pilots in the past were engaging their enemy's hand, or earlier than that, you were engaging your enemies in hand-to-hand combat. Now you're engaging your enemies via cameras from thousands of miles away. It does talk about the fact that the Air Force is struggling to get pilots for UAVs, and that things like people view it as a not necessarily combat. The U.S. military came up with a discussion about cyber warfare and drone pilots and cyber warfare, people getting a medal for their duties. And the veterans were in an uproar because their opinion was they fought hand-to-hand combat, or they were on the front lines, or they dogfighted. Someone who's sitting in the comfort of an air-conditioned room in the desert, thousands of miles or half a planet away from where they're actually fighting, isn't real combat. So this is a good primer for that. He does give you insights into the first Predator strike, which occurred in November of 2002, where the Predator took out a car, and that was the first remotely piloted aircraft attack that occurred, and that occurred in Yemen. I mean, it was a quantum leap coming up with the idea of attaching Hellfires to a drone to not only observe the enemy, but if necessary, combat the enemy.
Actually, David, that was developed primarily at the Army Research and Development Lab here at Redstone. It's called the AMRDEC, Aviation and Missile Research Engineering and Development Center, and they developed that in a Tiger team and did it very, very quickly, basically 6 to 8 weeks.
One of the interesting things that I thought that this article kind of illustrates was he took us through a 19-year-old soldier at the controls of a UAV with a Hellfire missile, and described the situation, what was happening on the ground, you know, in the war zone, and how it transpired that this, I'll call him a kid because he's just 19, ends up in support of some, I think it was Marines, but the troops on the ground took out a target. And then how he felt afterwards, and, you know, because he had just killed some people, and sort of the reaction that caused to sort of remotely take a life like that. So, I mean, these are big issues that, you know, a lot of people talk about and wrestle with, and some people are very passionate about. And I think in this article, he kind of sets the stage for how that happens and what does that mean to the people involved.
And said in the article in a tone in which you can have a useful conversation and not one that spirals out into shouting at each other.
From my perspective, I thought it was an extremely well-rounded and even-handed conversation or article that laid out, as you've pointed out, Max, all of the various aspects which go into it. And I didn't think it was very judgmental, which I thought was good. I actually met Mark Bowden back in 93 when he was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Oh.
He was researching his book called Killing Pablo. And he had just finished interviewing General Garrison and Danny McKnight and Mike Durant from the Black Hawk Down time. Very interesting fellow, and I think he's I don't think he's a friend of the military, but I think you can count on him to tell it as honestly as he can. And that to me is all I'd ask for.
So I think we all agree that this is an extremely well-written piece. It's not a matter of something that just speaks to the already converted, that it's a little more even balanced. And so really recommend it for not only those of us who are interested in this topic, but also others that might benefit from having this kind of objective view of the use of military drones.
Indeed.
Well, I guess that wraps up this week's episode.
It does. 30 minutes goes by fast. We want to thank our guest, Jamie Dodson, again, the Foreign Intelligence Officer and Senior Technology Protection Engineer for the U.S. Army Aviation and Missile Command. Jamie, tell folks where they can learn more about your writing about Nick Grant Adventures.
Well, I'm on Facebook at Nick Grant Adventure Fans. I'm also on the web. I've got a web presence with a lot of the background and the history associated with the world in which I immerse myself in for these novels. And that's at three words run together, nickgrantadventures.com.
All right. We'll put that in the show notes as well. So thanks so much for joining us, Jamie. We've had you on the Airplane Geeks podcast, and you've been a great supporter and contributor to that. So we want to thank you. And it's been a real pleasure having you join us here.
My pleasure, guys.
And for my two cents, you need to read the books. They're really good. And I want number four, Jamie.
And you can find us on the web at theuavdigest.com. If you want to send us an email, we have an address that you can use for that. The address is feedback@theuavdigest.com. And we're also on Twitter as UAVDigest.
And this week, as of this week, we actually have a Facebook presence also, facebook.com/UAV Digest.
And I just liked it.
All right. Very good. Thanks for setting that up, David. All right. I think that's it for this week. David, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Max.